Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me again is my co-host, Anna, environmental scientist and analyst. Welcome back, Anna.
Hi.
Today, we're talking about The Aristocats, Disney's 20th animated feature film, which came out on December 24th in 1970. At the time, the reviews were incredibly favorable. The New York Times, on its review on December 26th, said that it was grand fun all the way. Roger Ebert reviewed it on January 1st, 1971, and he said that it was light and pleasant and funny, and that while family movies are excruciating for anyone over 12, The Aristocats is not one of those dreadful exercises in simplicity. And Time magazine was even more ecstatic, saying that it was the platonic ideal of entertainment. 50 years later, after the so-called Disney Renaissance of the early 90s, I feel like its reputation has decreased significantly, perhaps because it was colored by the efforts of the director in some of the more mediocre films that followed. So our question today is, The Aristocats, 50 years later, how does it hold up?
I don't know about platonic ideal, Ben, but I thought it was really sweet. I think that this one is, I can't remember ever watching this when I was little, which surprised me, but it definitely plays like a Disney pop song, you know, like it hits all the notes. It feels like something you've heard a million times before, you know, even though I hadn't actually seen it. And I think that, you know, people definitely wouldn't be disappointed if what they're looking for is a Disney feel. Sometimes, like, you know, you sit down for like a DreamWorks movie and you're like, this isn't it at all. So I think that it definitely captures some of the important essence of like what Disney means to people. I don't know. What did you think, Ben?
One of my favorite film critics who came up in last week's Python episode is Mark Kermode of the BBC. And he once went on a couple of years long rant about how he considered Ice Age 2 to be, quote, the death of narrative cinema, unquote. And that he really wanted people to stand up at the end of it, proclaim that, and march out infuriated. Like, he was really incensed by how they had just abandoned storytelling for a gag structure. Which I think is interesting, particularly when paying attention to this film, which reviews on the re-releases, because this film not only came out in 1970, but came out again in theaters in 1980, and came out again in theaters in 1987, before finally being released on VHS in 1996, at which point it had made $130 million in those three box office releases. It was the most financially successful movie in the UK in 1971. It did very, very well. And yet the reviews from when it came out again and again 17 years later were that it didn't really have a plot, that it was sort of rambling, and there wasn't any urgency or peril, which makes it much more sort of like the Ice Age features in that there's a thing, sort of, but mostly it's just an opportunity to have a bunch of moments.
I think that's a totally fair criticism, but after having just sat through the Phantom Tollbooth, I think that this was like... a dream, such a finely crafted tight plot I have never experienced in an animated movie after.
You are still holding out branch of thorns for the Phantom Tollbooth, aren't you?
I'll never get over it.
Yeah, which is probably the sort of stuff that Ebert would have said, that was the kind of children's entertainment that only talked down, that didn't involve adults. Whereas I found that this film, it seemed to be about three different types of conflict. Culture clash, high versus low. Mm-hmm. The idea of a bachelor versus a family ties. And the idea of freedom versus ownership. all of those were summed up in the conversation between our lead Marmalade Tomcat, Thomas J. O'Malley, or
J. Thomas O'Malley,
or Abraham DeLacy, Giuseppe Casey Thomas O'Malley, the Alley Cat, depending on when he introduces himself. He seems to have no set name as well as no set abode.
I only got myself and this big old world.
There's one particular scene where the two of them are talking about a potential future. I say the two of them, I've neglected to introduce that Ava Gabor plays the part of Duchess, the Parisian house cat.
My name is Duchess.
Duchess. Beautiful.
In our 1910 French setting with her Hungarian accent. And there's this tension of, can they make it work together?
Darling, if only I could.
But why can't you?
Because of Madame. Well, I could never leave her.
Except the film isn't about that. There's almost no opportunities for the two characters to show we're from different worlds. I like this, you like that, we could never be together. It's just taken as read that there is no possibility for the two of them. But the character world building in the film is non-existent. The adventure is, can we get back home to our mistress? Can we get this tomcat to come with us? Will he stay? Is the most threadbare of tensions. And eventually, when he does end up in the house with a nice little collar on in order to show that he's domesticated enough, posing for a family photograph with the other cats, there's been no challenges, no hurdles to go over. Their owner just says, and this lovely young man that you've brought to my door, he'll stay, of course.
And I think this young man is very handsome. Shall we keep him in the family? Of course we will. We need a man around the house.
Because we need a man in the house.
Right. Right.
Which I think was a tongue-in-cheek sort of like a wink.
I mean, he pretty much says that earlier in the movie. He's like,
well, you know, they need a, well, you know, a father around.
And then when Duchess says, I need to go back to my human, I'm not going to live out here in your abandoned six-story house with your jazz musicians.
Mm.
One of the kittens says,
well, we almost had a father.
Yeah.
As if that had been a thing that had been brought up before. I spent so much time watching this movie distracted by thoughts of cat sex. Which is not the purpose of this movie.
I mean, one reviewer described them as like the thirstiest cats of like American cinema or like of all of Disney. Mm. I thought that was very apt.
Yeah, for a bunch of drawings that very carefully have no genitals, we are at the same time presented with this mother cat with her three kittens, all of whom have different colors. A thing I spent a little bit of time reading about and found myself very much over my head in terms of genetics. Did not really understand what I was reading, except for the fact that white is a dominant gene and another color is the recessive gene. So a white cat could have white cat children and one other or tabby colored children, but that's it. They couldn't have both black and orange and white children, because that's three different kinds of genetics instead of just two.
I'm surprised you didn't save this for the quiz.
Well, you know that the quiz is based on what minute comes up according to random.org, and so it was not the luck of the draw on that regard. But there's a large portion of the movie because we have these three different cats. We have Berlioz, the black fur with the untied cord for a collar. We have Toulouse, the marmalade with the I want to be a scamp energy. And we have Marie with the British accent, the pink bow in her hair and the giant pink bow on her back. And Marmalade Boy really wants to be a wildcat. And like, it's clear that he's designed not just because he's modeled after the painter Toulouse. And orange is a more natural color for a painter cat, I guess. But also, you want him to identify with the orange Thomas O'Malley as a natural father even though it's not his natural father. You want there to be that kinship there in terms of wish fulfillment.
I'm a tough valley cat, too.
Hey there. You're coming on. I bet you're a real tiger in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work. Not that Disney movies have ever been accused of being realistic, but if you're going to have these lines of dialogue about, gosh, it's too bad that he's not going to be our dad, then why not have a line about what happened? Was he run over by a milk truck? Did Duchess get adopted from the pound, already pregnant, by Madame Adelaide Bonfamille? Cats have fathers. Are we suggesting this litter is the Immaculate Conception?
Except that, like, cats don't have fathers. Like, if you think about, like, every cat litter that has ever shown up in a child's life since the beginning of time, cats don't have dads. Kittens show up in closets. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah.
I do. In the classic way in which you can never deny your mother because she was there, but your father can be radically suspect.
Such a mystery. Right. And so I think in that way that they are cats left it open for Disney to be like, these are cats and it's okay that there's no dad and we don't have an explanation for it. I think it was an interesting choice to not really address it at all, in the sense that we are anthropomorphizing these characters. And so it wouldn't have been far-fetched to be like, our dad who we lost in the war, or, you know, whatever. more to your point about there is a missing character in this family puzzle.
Because in general, we're all aware of the fact that Disney characters are missing a parent. Like, it's almost a requirement.
Right.
Cinderella has a stepmother, but no father or mother.
But I don't think that's ever answered, right? So maybe this is sort of like a Disney trope in these movies that, like, we just sort of understand that there's going to be parents missing and we don't really know why and we need to move forward.
Because it creates a hole in their sense of well-being that needs to be fulfilled by a prince or whatever. That there's that sense of, I need something that will allow me to be complete, and a romantic pairing will make that happen. They had stable parents. They might be like, actually, you know what? I'm okay.
I'm a whole person who can just be happy on my own. Nor can we return too deeply to the source and be like, well, I lost my dad this way, but I've come to terms with it. You know, we can't look too deeply at the origin story, grow through it, and become whole that way. No. We have to have a gaping hole that propels us towards the end point.
Of course, this has no origin story. This is the first original Disney story since Dumbo, which came out in, I wrote this down, but not seeing it immediately, 1941, perhaps? And so it's been a considerable amount of time since there was an attempt at having something that wasn't already vaguely iconic, and therefore might have had some of those kinks worked out in tellings and retellings beforehand. So this is based on an original story that was brought to Disney and then refined by a team of 7 credited writers on screen, compared to 1 credited writer on screen for The Sword in the Stone, 2 films earlier in 1963. And if I recall correctly, 5 credited writers for The Jungle Book, which was 4 years earlier. So a marked increase in a significant jump in 3 films in terms of authorship. This is also, having looked at earlier credit sequences, this is part of a trend since The Jungle Book of highlighting character actors. In Sword in the Stone and 101 Dalmatians, there are listings of voice actors, said, featuring the voice talents of, or featuring the talents of. But in Jungle Book, which was also directed by the same person who mounted this production, Wolfgang Reitherman was moving towards the idea that voice talent needed to be put up there in the opening credits, that you should get excited that this features the voice of Baloo the Bear, that it features the voice of Winnie the Pooh, that it features Ava Gabor and other characters from the rash of television shows that show up in this film. That's the beginning of the Disney move of celebrity stunt casting instead of just the voice actors aren't as important as the characters they're playing. I feel like I was moving towards a point there, but it's gone now. I will say that we mentioned when we talked about the Phantom Tollbooth that there was a little bit in there of a criticism about Xerox-based technology. And the visuals in this were done in part by a technique that was developed where sketches could be scanned electrostatically directly onto a cell. And this allowed for the painting to be done without an in-between process to help speed things up. This was not the first film to be done that way. It had been used in 101 Dalmatians, but it was definitely what contributed to a number of the individual cells in this that still had the sketch and structure lines on it. I don't know if how much you noticed that when you were watching it, but a lot of the drawings would, for a moment, have extra sketchy lines around or in it that would come and go as the cells moved. This is generally considered to be, therefore, one of the films in which the animation isn't that great, even though the reviews at the time said that it was beautiful. You had expressed an interest in revisiting Lady and the Tramp, which is generally considered to be a very similar storyline, but also to have more beautiful, rounded animation that's not as flat or simplistic as some of this. Did you have a chance to look and compare the visuals?
I did. And it is more beautiful. And I think that that's part of the reason why Aristocats probably does not hold up as such a classic. My Lady and the Tramp, I think, is more beloved. Although, you know, reasonable people will disagree. the cat lovers don't at me. The visual, I mean, even in the opening scenes is strikingly different from Aristocats, in my opinion. And the effects that you're describing of the animation style, like throughout the Aristocats, but it seemed a little bit murkier, a little bit less crisp, a little bit less polished by the end of their production process.
I thought that was very interesting. I generally don't assume that an animated feature is constructed chronologically, that the final scenes are the final ones to be animated. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense. You would animate the hardest things first so that you have the most time on them. And a major action sequence featuring a band of jazz musician cats, a horse, and mouse all attacking a butler that has a cat and three kittens in a crate would be complicated and therefore have a lot of effort put into it early on in the process. But it also felt rushed. It felt like it didn't maintain scale, that it didn't have a good physical sense of surroundings, and it did feel like a last-minute effort, which was counterintuitive. And that surprised me, that I was naturally sort of feeling like, well, they must have run out of time on this, despite the fact that I sincerely doubt that they assembled it in order. And it was kind of a weak sauce ending on a number of different levels.
This must be the trunk, eh?
Yep, and she goes all the way to Timbuktu.
But can you describe at all how different Lady and the Tramp looked? Like, what aspects of it seemed more beautiful?
Sure. You know, it was interesting. Like, in the opening scene, you know, we see the snow is falling. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Is this a Christmas movie? Because I know Aristocats opened, you know, as a Christmas movie. And I went and looked it up. I guess it was released in June. So no, not a Christmas movie. Although I recommend Lady and the Tramp as a Christmas movie if you're looking for some alternative Christmas movies. Very sweet. Everything looks very smooth. It doesn't even look like animation almost. It looks painted. Everything has, like, if you reached out and touched it, it would be soft to the touch. And then I think each unfolding scene has that, like, a softness and a brightness and a polish to it that the Aristocats, although beautiful, lots to it was beautiful, had, like, a sketched quality to every scene, which is, I think, not typical of Disney. Like, I do remember now, like, in the opening, some of the opening scenes of the Aristocats, somebody who is sort of a main character, sort of not, and like the owner of the cats, like, she's very, mm-hmm. she's old. She's an old lady that we see, but mm-hmm. she's a benevolent old lady. Kind of cool for a Disney movie. Don't always get those. Often they're evil. She's and she's very beautiful. And I was like, this is so nice. But the way that she's drawn is a little sketchy. And the way that she moves across the screen is a little bit almost like she's underwater. And the way that, and it's not unpleasant, but it was a little bit, I remember being a little surprised because it didn't feel very Disney. Especially for somebody who, you know, grew up watching like the Disney sort of Renaissance movies from the 80s and 90s, you know, like The Little Mermaid and Aladdin. Those are very...
Well, she's almost photorealistic, the character of Madame.
That's interesting.
She's not truly rotoscoped, but she has a very deliberately human quality. And I think a number of the cat movements also alternate between seeming like true cat behavior, as close to photorealistic cat behavior as possible, and then switch into cartoonishness as they need to. Like, there's this constant push-pull relationship between we want it to feel real and not. And in the case of the human characters, you have Madame, who is very refined in the way in which she's presented as close to realistic, and then she's surrounded by Disney-esque cartoons where you have Georges, who is bow-legged and crooked and giant fake blinking eyes and has nothing realistic.
Tararaboom, yeah, tararaboom, whoops, oh, not as spry as I was when I was 80, eh?
And the butler, Edgar, who has this giant honking nose and a beatific presence and the traditional spotted boxer shorts and bracers and, you know, is very much a cartoon in the style in which you expect characters to be designed in. So she's interesting in that she doesn't mesh with the people surrounding her.
Mm-hmm.
And the cats, similarly, have that sense of their... realistically feline in some moments, and then the jazz cats are just drawings of cats without any sort of attempt at having them be something you could see on a camera.
I'm just going to throw this out there. I think that they took the wizard from Sword in the Stone and they just reused him for George.
Well, I can't speak specifically to that, but Reitherman is notorious for reusing animation. So there's footage of tigers and the snake that gets used in the Jungle Book that gets reused in Robin Hood. And there's footage of cats that gets used in one scene in Aristocats that then gets reused later in the movie. The veteran animators at Disney found this to be appalling. Like, they hated the fact that he was just clipping out previous animation, whereas Reitherman felt that he was keeping things on budget and on time. Although other people said that it was just as hard to reanimate old footage as it was to come up with new footage, and so that he wasn't actually saving time or money. But all he was doing was taking a gag or taking something that pre-existed and being able to go back to the same well and say, well, that was just as funny the first time. Let's reuse it exactly the same the second time, and we'll get the same laugh.
What,
but I don't think that's what works.
Well, I think that's part of the reason why Aristocats has that pop song feel. You know, like what I was talking about in the opening, where like you can kind of hum along even though you've never heard it before. You're like, oh yeah, that character feels so familiar. Where have I seen that? I think that for a lot of people, for kids, I think it would be nice. You know, feels familiar, feels nice. And for a lot of grown-ups as well who want a nostalgia feeling. But I think for a standalone artistic merit question, I think that probably I would side more with his animators who are frustrated and, you know, and want to create something unique and fresh.
A criticism that exists now is that the Thomas O'Malley character is way too similar to Baloo. that
he is Baloo.
He is Baloo. It's the same voice actor.
And you're like, where do I? Oh, it's Baloo.
Yeah. And so that's the knife edge that you're describing is, do I like this because I like Baloo, and therefore give me a cat version of Baloo with basically the same voice and it will make me feel comfortable? Or do you feel like you're being cheated because you're not being given something that's pushing the boundaries and doing something new?
Well, I mean, on first take, a lot of critics really liked it.
Right.
Maybe they didn't notice that it was Baloo.
I think it was pretty prominently Baloo. And the songwriter who crafted the Thomas J. O'Malley introductory tune was the person who wrote Bare Necessities. It was written by Terry Gilkison, is how it's pronounced, potentially. They were the collaborators on that, and they were brought back to get that same kind of hit again. Bare Necessities, a song so popular, they put it in the new CGI version of Jungle Book, despite the fact that Jungle Book wasn't supposed to be a musical in the new CGI, quote, live action version, because they wanted to get away from that. But they brought back that song because audience, test audiences and the animators felt like it was missing without it. So incredibly popular, went back to that well.
And I would say, like, in this movie, it seems like they're trying to recreate the magic of Bare Necessities. Mm-hmm. They hit close. They don't get there. And that, again, is why, like, Aristocats almost makes it, but cannot rise to the level of, like, this classic, like, you know, like how we see Jungle Book with or without its problematic issues, you know, is a beloved classic, where Aristocats is sort of a forgettable, like, maybe I did, maybe I didn't see it as a kid, and I probably could have lived without ever seeing it, but, you know, where it's enjoyable, but not, not necessary. It's not a bare necessity.
It's not. I grew up with a record version, an LP version of the Aristocats, where they'd taken this hour and 18 minute movie and compressed it down to 45 minutes, chopping out a lot of the more visual parts and slimming it down. And I listened to it a lot because they had the funny bits. They had the music and they had the hound dogs, and they got rid of a bunch of the other stuff because it didn't translate. And so for me, the voice that really comes back to me are the voices of the two dogs, of Lafayette and Napoleon.
Lafayette, listen. Oh, shucks, Napoleon, that ain't nothing but a little old cricket bug. It's Squeaky Shoes approaching.
Who are played by two actors who appeared on Green Acres and Barney Miller? I'm going to get this wrong. But one of those voices is also the voice of the Wild West bullets that show up in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And I have an incredibly visceral response to the scene in Roger Rabbit when Eddie Valiant opens up his Toon gun in the back of his car to get into Toontown, and all the guys are in there going, Eddie Valiant, why, you're a sight for sore eyes. I ain't seen you to nigh on to 5 years. Where you been? Like, it is, my whole body galvanically responds to that, and I've had no idea why until I revisited this movie, because those dog voices are the same voices, and to me, that's the, like, I had never watched this slew of cornpone, terrible backwoods sitcoms that were so popular on television for years. In fact, this year, 1970, is the year that they stopped making them. They moved away from that. They abandoned heartland-focused television in order to start doing urban-related television. The Mary Tyler Moore Show and The Odd Couple were two of the vanguards of creating city life television, aside from the sort of stuff that was Hee Haw, that was Green Acres, that was this very much middle America rural vision of entertainment, and that the executive said, nope, that's not what the future is. That's not the stories that people will care about. And when this was announced, there was a revolt that those shows were being canceled. except for the fact that those executives were right, that we moved away from that being the focus of Heartland Entertainment, and we stopped making shows for those people until the more recent slew of country cop shows starring grizzled old men in their 60s, like Kevin Costner and Longmire and Big Sky. And like, there's this new resurgence in real American crime shows.
Real American.
That's right. That is the correct way to pronounce that.
No, that's interesting. I hadn't put that all together before. So these dogs, do you think that the director was stealing these dogs from Lady and the Tramp?
Well, I didn't rewatch Lady and the Tramp for this.
Okay.
I took a look at 101 Dalmatians, which I'd never seen, and which was released 9 years and 11 months to the day before this movie. Because it used that similar animation style. 101 Dalmatians and Sleeping Beauty were both created in a time when Disney was looking at a kind of flatted, more abstract drawings, where they were simplifying things instead of going in a more lush, rounded direction. They were going in a more 20s modern direction in terms of the line work and the influences. Things were more like a certain style of cartoon that you would see in The New Yorker, perhaps, that kind of line drawing. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to see how successful it was there before they started to get into the Raitherman House style of reusing things. Because let me tell you, when I rewatched The Jungle Book in theaters sometime in the last 30 years when it came out, I remember being pissed at the recycling of footage. Like, I saw Ka get knocked down from a tree branch and fall in the exact same way twice. And I said, that is a damn cheat. I was angry at the fact that they weren't doing the animation fresh, because there's no way that a real animal would fall the exact same way twice. And it didn't make me laugh at the repetition. It made me angry that they had decided to cut corners. Mm-hmm. And I feel strongly that this movie is filling itself out with reused footage. That the introduction, the title sequence, has non-colored in footage that gets then we see in its fully fledged version later in the show. That the ending is a montage of stuff that we've already seen against a different background. That they are cutting corners in order to fill out a very short running time. and I found an article that said that the eventual budget of the film was approximately $4 million. And that Reitherman was proud at coming in at that amount. Snow White had cost $1.7 million. And in 1968, there was a report that said that feature films from Disney had ballooned to the cost of $5 million and $6 million. So for Reitherman to bring this in at only $4 million meant that he was probably heralded as a bit of success, that we got our movie out and we got it in under expectations. But I think that the way they did that was by having a product that showed its scaffolding and showed its stitching and didn't have clean seams.
Yeah, it's too bad. I think that the sense that I get is that Aristocats is beloved, you know, it's sort of like a cult classic for the people who do love it, you know, whether it's because, you know, people really love cats or really are into the characters, you know, or like saw it as a kid and really attached to it, or, you know, whatever it is. I don't know if this happened to you when you were doing research, but like if you Google Aristocats, you can buy a Disney licensed diamond necklace in the shape of the... Did that not come up for you? For our listeners, the look on Ben's face is one of, I think, shock and disappointment that he was not offered this by Google search algorithm.
First of all, I think our listeners probably have assumed, based on the many hours of commentary I've given on this, that my natural voice does not indicate the kind of character that would drape himself in Disney diamonds, let alone Disney zirconium.
If you want to make Ben happy this Christmas, you can send him you heard that he grew up listening to the Aristocats on record. You know that this is what his heart truly desires. So Disney licensed Aristocats necklace. I think it's from K Jewelers.
Every kiss of death begins with K.
Yeah, so I mean, based on that, I think there's people willing to, you know, drop some G's on some Aristocat swag. And
yeah, yeah.
It's
no.
emotional.
And Disney has turned into a company that is aware of the fact that it develops its movies based on exploitation. And that's not a dirty word or a judgmental word. That's literally what it's referred to in the industry, is the way in which they're going to be able to capitalize on licensing aspects. That you don't just design a film, you design a film that has characters that are, as the director of Batman Forever and Batman and Robin referred to them, toyetic. That you have the ability to turn them into merchandise. And so they need to be distinct enough from other characters, but that also can go on a Burger King glass. And if you haven't hit that balance of, we can do posters and t-shirts and necklaces and spin-offs of all sorts of kinds with the characters in this, if we haven't started creating that kind of affinity, then we're not fully fledging our product for that kind of exploitation. That is specifically how media is developed these days, with an awareness of that extra features. And Walt at the time knew that things would pay for themselves eventually through repeat viewings and through building a leadership, that most of his films weren't immediately successful, but they would become successful over time. Through things like Disneyland and Disney World, by people going and feeling the warmth of the product around them, and therefore buying ancillary products or going back to the feature as it came out again and again. It was all based on a huge long-term experiential investment that is now part of the immediate conception of these future products.
I've never had one of our recording sessions make me want to shower so bad.
Not even Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces.
No. I feel like that's a par for the course. I don't know. Just like
yeah, but this is par for the course. And that's part of the point, is that this has been going on for more than 50 years. It's just, it's been worked into a fine science.
Yeah. Yes, I hope that George Lucas is very cozy wherever he may be. That's the thing I think of the most when I think of Disney, like the Disney toy empire. I don't know if I'm really prepared to have this conversation right now, but do we, not that we have to feel a particular way, so maybe I should use a different pronoun here. Do you... Not the there is no we here.
Definitely not in a movie set in France in 1910 where everyone has American and British accents. There is no we here.
No way, no how. Do you think that Disney is
evil?
Force? I was going to ask you if you thought it was a force for good in the world. That's a hard left, actually. But yeah, I think that we've been describing some ways that it's evil, but actually... I'm curious if you think that, because, okay, so part of the question there that I'm asking is, you know, I went and I signed up for Disney Plus to watch Lady and the Tramp. And so a lot of what they're doing now is like they have all these old movies that they're showing on Disney Plus, you know, because they're like they've pulled it all into their little empire. And before these movies that have this problematic content, they have a screen that they show. Right. You know what I'm talking about? Where they're like,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
They're like, hey, this stuff isn't cool now. It wasn't cool then. And we're leaving it in here. And we hope that you'll have a conversation about it.
Now, I remember when Disney Plus first got launched, there was some discussion about the footage because it specifically went in front of Dumbo, because they were talking about the racist crows that appeared in Dumbo. If I were to read something out to you, do you believe you would remember whether it's what you saw?
I think so.
This is the me commenting on this online because I... felt that Disney had taken a very cowardly piece of language about providing that kind of context to their product compared to what Warner Brothers and Looney Tunes had done in their Golden Collection. And I put out a thing that said, Disney needs to do better with the language on this. And it's the first time that someone random on the internet has called me a snowflake. And the hilarious thing about it is I didn't even realize that's what was going on, because they tweeted three snowflake emojis in response to my comment. And I just thought, winter? So in front of Dumbo from 1941, the description ends with the sentence, "This program is presented as originally created. It may contain outdated cultural depictions." It says that after it says, "contains tobacco depictions," as if they're just as worried about crows smoking cigars as anything else. But the Warner Brothers language is, "The cartoons you are about to see are the products of their time. They may depict some of the ethnic and racial prejudices that were commonplace in American society. These depictions were wrong then and are wrong today. While the following does not represent the Warner Brothers view of today's society, these cartoons are being presented as they were originally created, because to do so otherwise would be the same as claiming these prejudices never existed." Do you have a vague feeling as to what Disney Plus said?
Yeah, it was much closer to the Warner Brothers version.
That's good.
Yeah.
I'm glad that they've moved in that direction.
Yes.
Because that was, Disney Plus launched almost a year ago. So that was November 2019 that language was foisted off on the general public. Did you at all check out whether or not that warning was in front of the Aristocats?
I think it was. Yeah, actually, when I was doing some research, some Googling, I think that had recently been added to the Aristocats and to some other movies as well. Like, they're sort of expanding like where it belongs.
Because we've talked about Scat Cat and his band of jazz cats a couple of times, but we haven't specifically mentioned Shun Gon, the apparent name of the incredibly distracting racial stereotype Chinese cat that is the pianist and drummer in the band, who, to my eye, I really think they thought he was hilarious. Like, the moments in which he is highlighted are loud. There is a British hippie cat, vaguely in the line of John Lennon. There is a giant Russian cat who reminds me of Brian Blessed. There's an Italian cat who, in dress, is as much like Chico Marx as anything else. It just occurs to me. All of them are varying stereotypes to a degree, but none of them come across as outrageously as the Chinese cat does, who not only has a moment where he plays the piano with chopsticks, but also then just sings two lyrics of a bunch of non-sequitur Chinese words together in a way that's clearly supposed to make the audience laugh. But they're also drop-ins. Like, they have the feeling of they could have been taken out of the song with no effort, which makes me wonder if they were added into the song because somebody thought that it needed a little bit of a punch, that it needed extra jokes, and so they dropped them in there in order to give it something more. Because the other cats don't have that same punchline-based relationship with it, but they really went for it with that particular cat.
Yeah, I'm not sure how to speculate about like what the decision making might have been around that particular character. It seems like a little bit less plot oriented than, say, like, you know, in Lady and the Tramp, you know, like the Siamese cats, and like they have a whole song and like a whole sort of relationship with Lady. And not that I remember anything about that. I think I started watching Lady and the Tramp and I was like, oh my God, I think this was like my favorite movie when I was little. Like, it really brought me back.
but that's important, because you are talking about the idea that for some people, this must be one of their favorite Disney movies, that they must have incredibly fond memories of that. And my memory of listening to the record means that these songs are in my head.
Yeah.
Like, I can sing probably 80% of Everybody Wants to Be a Cat without thinking about it, because I've been re-exposed to it and re-exposed to it. And yet there's this incredibly racist cul-de-sac right in the middle of it that I never think about.
Mm-hmm.
I am also part of the problem that part didn't affect me or bother me, and therefore I didn't think that it was a problem.
100%. And I think that this is what Gen Z means when they look at us and they say, you need to decolonize your mind. And we say, but I've been, and they say, no. You know, like it's in there and it's hard to even recognize. And, you know, we can work on our whole lives, but on my deathbed, the things that are going to be going through my head are like the Siamese cat song from Lady and the Tramp. You know, it's just in there, man.
I do. And music is particularly seductive in that way. Yeah. Well-written, catchy music makes you not pay attention to what you're saying because it has a process that makes you feel good by creating tension and release in terms of chord structure.
I think that, you know, probably like your snowflake friend on Twitter would be, you know, like if they were listening to this conversation.
Friend, we're close. We're
tight. Yeah. Go way back. They would probably say, but what does it matter? What could it possibly matter? Do you have like a few lyrics from a song? You can't even remember that it's in your head. Like, what does it matter? And I think that for me, going back to these movies from 1970, we're at now, you know, 50 years ago, you know, or Lady and the Tramp even earlier, and noticing how they build the fabric of my subconscious. It's not one movie or another or one lyric or another. It's the way that they comprise the mosaic of my subconscious, you know, or, you know, Breakfast at Tiffany's. I think that's another one where it's like, you know, the first time I watched it. Yeah. It's like this sweet movie that I love, you know, Audrey Hepburn. Oh my gosh, what a philanthropist, what a, you know, goodwill ambassador for the world. But that, you know, revisiting them as an adult and being like, oh, you know, this is actually not the person that I'm trying to be in the world.
And similarly, you have Mickey Rooney in yellow face shouting at her from the top floor.
100%. And that you have to undo these things that you did not mean to do as a young person, took in media, but that it, you know, it's a part of you and that you accidentally built a foundation for yourself about the world and what's okay.
Which is therefore interesting about the attempts at establishing theme and conflict in the movie that we went to earlier about the idea of the domestic bliss of getting this tomcat to settle down. That's not explicit in the text, and yet because it's part of the essential assumptions that the film makes in terms of its world building, that's what you should want. You should want a nuclear family heteronormative unit, and that therefore you should bring in and tame this feral cat and make him into a father figure. Of course, that's the happy ending. That is part of the unconscious assumption that does get woven into you, that you don't need to build it in the storyline. You don't need to lay train tracks for that if it's part of the unquestioning part of the yes that the movie wants you to say.
And this has been part of Disney's main motor for almost all of Disney's existence, you know, up until fairly recently. You know, we have movies like Frozen, where like the central engine of that is more about like the relationship between the sisters rather than the romantic interest, which it also has.
It gets to have its cake and eat it too.
Right. Yeah. I think they're still getting to a new dawn with that. You know, and Disney has done arguably some other work on their heteronormativity, whether or not you consider ABC to be part of the Disney empire, but Sleeping Beauty and Little Mermaid and like all of the Disney empire, I would say, like, is exactly what you're describing, this idea of reinforcing these heteronormative values of like, but of course you need to fall in love and have a man. And like, and I think that's been my biggest and longest resistance to Disney for my whole life, is like how frustrating that is.
Which then gets back to the heart of your question, is Disney doing good? Is it putting good out into the world? If you've created something that is assumed to be family friendly, that is default valued by most people as this is a thing that is good and okay and desirable for our families to have. If Disney Cruises and Disney World are thought of as ideal destinations, the whole joke about you've just won $1 million, what are you doing? I'm going to Disney World. That's the goal. I am now a millionaire. The first thing I'm going to do is go to heteronormative cartoon land. That's not great. That is the assumption that the message that they put out is the ideal. That means all of their messaging is also falls under that umbrella. Are they therefore creating a monoculture that is good? I would say no. unfortunately. I don't think, in fact, I'm very specifically feel like the hero myth that has come out of Disney has been warmly embraced in terms of so much of it is family is who you assemble. It's not who you're born with. That has been a very dominant, very popular central conceit of mass entertainment for at least 20 years, if not longer. And there are obvious benefits to that for people who need to be able to have a hearth when they've been rejected by their family for various reasons. On the other hand, it has created a cult of individualism and a degree of specialness that I find repugnant. That the hero myth of I am the special child and what has been in me all along is the thing that I just needed to cultivate, I think is anti-growth. I think very distinctly and very powerfully that it helps inculcate a belief that I am okay the way I am, and therefore anybody that's trying to change me is not helping me. And that's anti-learning, and it's anti-personal growth, and it therefore allows people to fall back into a narrative of saying, I don't need to be any better than I am right now, and I think that's a hot garbage thought proposition.
It's a technical term. Yeah, that's is that like the Harry Potter issue?
Right.
Or
which is Warner Brothers and which is, you know, TERF, but it has its own set of things that don't fall narrowly under the Disney window. But yes, it's also, I don't know, I'm sure I could come up with a Disney example if I'd paid attention to Disney. It's probably baked into Big Hero 6. It feels very much in Iron Man, where, you know, that particular idea of you just need to be true to yourself and get back to your core essence of who you are, and that's what will save the day, I think is an excuse for people to say, I only want to like the things that I like, and I don't need to try anything new. So I can reject solar panels and kale and...
and not receive criticism from others when I don't like it. Yeah, interesting. That's an interesting perspective.
It's not just Disney's fault, but because Disney is the strongest attempt at monoculture that exists at the moment, because they are constantly the ones that are saying, come into our big tent of entertainment, that they're the most successful and most powerful at being a brand that will suck you in like a gelatinous cube.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason why I asked the question is because it's really, it's easy to crap on Disney, right?
Yeah.
It's the obvious choice. I just, you know, it's, I wonder, I think that the part of me that's wondering is just about what it means to be a huge media company, like what it means to be a huge company and the opportunity that brings to also create change. It, like anyone can look at Disney and be like, well, of course they're terrible for all of these reasons. But I have a curiosity about also the people who mean to do good and whether or not there is a way for a company like Disney to do good, or if it's all just in the service of like profit and eventual upholding of the status quo. Like when they, you know, support the production of a character like Rey, or if they support, I don't know, I'm not really a Disney expert here. We can put some notes in post-production on their website.
Well, if you don't mind, I'll wrap this up by saying there are obviously at least two points of view on this, but there are two easy ones. In the 1890s, H.G. Wells believed in what was called the parliamentary road to socialism. And that he belonged to a political party who wanted to increase social support and structures in government. And so he believed the only way you could do that was by electing more officials into parliament that would gradually over time continue to increase humanitarian effort in the government. But you couldn't do it all at once. You didn't want to do it through violent overthrow. You needed to do it slowly and with a convincing of people over time. And then there are people who believe strongly that you can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools.
That quote came later, though.
Yeah. I mean, those are the two opinions. Right. And so there would be some people who would say, yes, Disney, because it's the most powerful vehicle for messaging in the world, is absolutely the organization and company that you want to go work for so that you have the greatest opportunity to reach the greatest amount of minds subconsciously or consciously, explicitly or implicitly, with messages that support a variety of perspectives on any level. Any victory is a victory because it will reach millions of people. And there are other people that will say, no, you only make the enemy stronger by filling their coffers. They will always be 90% conservative because they don't want to rock the boat and therefore burn it down and start over. Those are the two perspectives.
What do you think?
Depends on whether I'm feeling optimistic or pessimistic on any given day.
What way are you feeling
I also know that I am not fit to survive in a world where things have been burnt down.
That's realistic. I mean, I guess I think that should be part of the conversation, is like, how would we bring, not that there's a we in this conversation, like for people who want to tear things down and start over, like how do you ensure that you bring the people with you that you most want to bring?
Yeah.
Or would you be willing to sacrifice so very much? I'm not sure this is where we meant to go with Aristocats. Or maybe we did with a name like Aristocats. They got to know they're going to end up with some revolutionary talk by the end of the film.
On that note, let's move on to the quiz.
Oh, no.
Moving on to the excerpted minute, we asked the good people at random.org to choose one of the hour and 18 minutes from the film. Anna will watch that minute for its full 60 seconds. She will then have half that time to summarize it. If she successfully summarizes it in just 30 seconds, she gets a bonus point as we go into our five-question quiz. And are you ready for today's trial and tribulation?
No, but I will do my best.
You're a brave soldier. You are a rat going into an alley in search of the enemy in order to save Duchess and the kittens. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So today's randomly selected minute is minute number 35. Minute number 35.
She'd always say that we're the greatest treasure she could own. Because with us, she never felt alone.
All right. Your 30 seconds to summarize the minute starts now.
All right. We see Madame. She is sad. She has lost her cats. We see Frou Frou the horse talking to Roquefort the mouse. They don't know where the cats are. Roquefort can't find them. They're talking about how sad Madame is. Edgar comes in. He is happy.
10 seconds left.
And then he flips open his newspaper and reveals on the newspaper
that
he is the catnapper. It is the headline of the newspaper. Frou Frou is shocked.
Time! Congratulations, I think you did that.
I'm getting better, I think.
But I'm glad that you got to the final detail of Edgar showing the newspaper, because our quiz today is based on newspaper stories about actual catnappings. Because I thought that it was ludicrous that not just the headline, but also the sub columns on the front page were all about this rich lady's kidnapped cat. So I tried to see what kind of actual news presence catnappings have had in the past. Question number one. In 1950, the New York Times wrote about a catnapping in Chappaqua, New York, where Mrs. Rodney H. Carpenter was accused of using food to lure away two cats named Boots and Whiskers. Which of the following is not true? A. Anderson, the owner of the cats, claimed Carpenter lured the cats away knowing that Boots would soon have kittens and that Carpenter planned to sell them for profit. B. Carpenter claims she was feeding the cats because Anderson's 12-year-old daughter, the true owner, wasn't feeding them and they came to her of their own accord. Or C. The judge ruled that the ownership of the kittens was based on a 100-year-old appeals decision about the ownership of whiskey derived from stolen corn.
I guess B is not true.
Unfortunately, A is not true. There was no speculation as to the motive of selling the kittens. Question number two. In 1982, the Times claimed a cat had led the police to a location of stolen goods, arts, antiques, and jewels. How did this cat manage that? A. The cat was stolen with the items, and the thief gave the cat to his girlfriend. His children, mentioning the pet, gave the police probable cause to search the girlfriend's property. B. A cat clawed through a stolen painting, and upon attempting to get it restored, the repair artist recognized the original as stolen and reported it. Or C. While searching the premises, the police noticed a cat pawing and scratching at a panel in the wall, which turned out to be a concealed door. They discovered several mouse traps, some occupied, and a cache of stolen antiques.
Well, I love C. I don't know if it's the right one, but that's my favorite.
Unfortunately, it was A. It was that the kids knew about the cat. Well, I'm glad that you think I'm more entertaining than reality.
Much more.
Question number three. In the Guardian newspaper in 2020, Colin Butcher, a retired police detective, was interviewed about pet seductions, where people feed and welcome a cat to entice it to stay. He said that men don't seduce cats, but, quote, there is a crazy cat lady on every street, unquote. The worst case he ever investigated was A. A woman with 28 cats would leave uncanned cat food out for weeks on end and then just never clean it up, attracting insects and pests. B. A woman had stolen 16 cats and secretly kept them all locked away in her attic. Or C. A woman who only had 2 cats, but when one died, she'd kidnap another and feed the previous one to the new pair, quote, to make them both stronger, unquote.
Ew. If you made that last one up, I think we should talk. I think A is the answer.
No, it was the boring middle one. 16 cats in the attic.
That was the boring one.
Question number 4. Also in The Guardian, Butcher claims that a certain percentage of cats have been adopted by owners who think that they're lost or runaway, but which really never are runaways. They just wander between residences. He says that A, 100% of outdoor cats have a territory of 3 or 4 houses. B, 90% of outdoor cats are fed at least 2 houses. C, 50% of outdoor cats have 2 houses. Or D, 20% of outdoor cats have 2 to 3 houses.
I'd say it's like 50%. That sounds right to me.
Correct. And for your final question, I did a little digging as to whether or not there were any historical instances of cat inheritance that might have inspired the Aristocats. And I discovered that Mrs. Margaret Montgomery, when she died in 1959, left her estate to her cats, making them the richest cats in Chicago. William Fields, then 70 years old, would inherit whatever was remaining of the estate when the 5 cats died. When, in 1968, Flatnose, the final of the 5 cats, died at age 20, how much did he inherit? A. A mere $2,000. B. $15,000. C. $65,000. Or D. $112,000.
C.
Unfortunately, either B or D would have been correct, because $15,000 in 1968 is worth $112,000 today.
Oh my gosh. I thought that this movie was based on something that actually did happen in 1910, but you're saying that the story that it was based on happened in 1950-something?
Well, I can't prove that newspaper stories about the richest cat in Chicago in 1959 would have inspired the writers to have come up with their screenplay in 1963, which is when the original story got pitched to Disney before being finalized in 1968. But this newspaper story also appeared in 1968 about that case from 9 years earlier. So it was in the warp and the weft of the news specifically one about a 70-year-old caretaker who might not live to actually see the results of the inheritance, much like Edgar, who believed that he would have been too old by the times the kittens died.
Each cat will live about 12 years. I can't wait. And each cat has 9 lives. That's 4 times 12 and multiply by 9 times... No, it's less than that. Anyway, it's much longer than I'd ever live.
Yeah.
Sounds like it could have been the inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you received 2 out of 5 points. Just not quite enough to tie or win, which means you will be facing the gauntlet of 5 more ridiculous questions next time we gather.
It's my lot. It's my lot in life.
First Perspective was created and developed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. This episode was researched, recorded, and produced by the presenters. Editing by Ben Russell. Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song was mixed from recordings of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community. You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farcenamebasis. If there are things, facts, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website. We will post it to our errata page on Farce Perspective as soon as possible. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, and our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben, my co-host is Anna, and we'll see you next time when we discuss another comic touchstone celebrating a key anniversary.